feeling mighty lonesome, haven't slept a wink. I walk the floor and watch the door, and in between I drink black coffee.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dr. Tish Oney. She's been a soloist with symphony orchestras, big bands, choirs, jazz combos throughout the world. She's a musicologist, an author, a multi-genre singer, arranger, composer, producer, and conductor. And we're talking about her latest book, Peggy Lee, A Century of Song. Tish, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you wrote this. Peggy Lee was born in North Dakota, Norma Dolores Eggstrom, in May 1920. So this is her centennial year.
That's correct.
And that's obviously why you wrote it, besides the fact that you love her music.
Yes, it was good timing.
Now, you must have planned it. It wasn't just fun.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, I did plan it, but it turned out to be a good time to unravel that plan.
Now, Peggy Lee, as you say in the beginning of your book, has a six-decade catalog of music in big band, swing, pop, jazz, blues. She did work on radio, television, and film. And the first thing I thought of when I finished your book is, for any of these collectors who are completists, this must be a nightmare to try to collect everything that she ever recorded.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, when I set out to write this book, I wanted to write about every song, and I very quickly became aware that that would be impossible.
It would be a very long book. Yeah. But the amazing thing, and this is one of the many things that I learned in your book, is how many of her recordings were kept in the can until sometimes many years later?
Yeah. Well, I don't know the exact number, but unfortunately, a large number of her original songs were held off. So she would record them, and then the Capitol execs would decide what would be on the albums and what singles would be released, and those other extraneous, they felt, masters would just be set aside.
And the amazing thing is, even though some of these have not been released except decades afterwards, I'm amazed that the recordings still exist.
Yes, and the quality is really very high. Anything that has been released posthumously had to meet with Capitol's expectations for their recordings, and so it's really quite amazing how wonderful these things sound.
Well, let's talk a little bit about her early life. She, as I mentioned, grew up in North Dakota. She had an abusive stepmother, an alcoholic father, and set off for California pretty early on in her career. Mm-hmm. And she worked with Benny Goodman. That's the first major sort of milestone in her career. Overall, how was that experience for her working with Benny Goodman, and what did she get out of it?
Oh, great question. I think Benny Goodman was actually a very good match for her as far as band leading, because he was, first of all, the king of swing. He was out in front of many other bands already. He was extremely motivated, self-motivated, and very active. He had a very high level of excellence that he demanded from his band. And so she was exposed at a young age to somebody who was really on par with her as far as technique and hard work ethic and expectations. So he really set her sights very high, I think.
The other thing that comes out, and this is one of the things I really appreciate about your book, is because you're a singer yourself and the fact that you're also a doctor, you're able to talk about specific qualities about her vocal approach to songs that sort of makes her different, sets her apart of the crowd, and I want to talk about that. For instance, on song Where or When, she uses an ultra-soft vocal technique, which ends up being her go-to strategy to make audiences listen, like to do it sort of quietly and soft, and it does get the audiences to listen. Did she really develop her vocal sort of bag of tricks during the Benny Goodman years?
I think she experimented a lot during the Goodman years and really discovered where she would shine above some of the others that were recording at the time. Yes, So I think she had some time and opportunity to explore. She was able to come in singing Helen Forrest's pieces in Helen's keys, in her soprano keys, and she did it beautifully well with wonderful technique. But very quickly decided that she wanted to sing in the spoken range. She felt it gave her more power of expression and really wanted to place the lyric in a prominent place.
You also talk a lot about what the records were actually like at that time. And these early recordings with Benny Goodman, they charted, but they were 78 RPM singles?
Yes.
And they were released virtually unedited or mixed?
That's right. That's right.
And that was typical?
That was normal. That's how selective the record companies were about the artists that were on their rosters. So people like Bing Crosby and Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra could conceivably have a near-perfect recording session, you know, song after song after song, which is why they were hired and others were not.
Oh, now, were they recorded on both sides, or was it one side?
I'm not 100%
okay, don't worry
sure
about, it.
About that.
Now, a song...
I think it was both sides, because on the flip side of a hit, there often was something else that they wanted to promote.
Now, she did a lot of classics, like Blues in the Night, which is a Mercer Arlen composition. But when she recorded Why Don't You Do Right, I want you to talk about that. You described that as a song that really changed the trajectory of her career. Explain to me why. Let's talk about that song.
Yes. Well, it was recorded shortly after Peggy Lee and Benny Goodman were appearing in New York's Paramount Theater. Mm-hmm. And so Goodman walked into... her dressing room, and she was playing it. It was a Lil Green recording, and Peggy was singing along, and he said, "You really like that song, don't you?" And she said, "Yeah, I love this song." And he thought about it for a moment, and he said, "Would you like me to arrange it so that we could do it?" And she said, I would love nothing more. I would love to do that song." And so that's how that came about. He actually heard her playing the recording in her dressing room, and she would play it over and over and over again.
Now, did she sing that song in Stage Door Canteen?
Yes, she did.
Now, that brings up another whole thing about Peggy Lee that maybe many young listeners don't realize. She was in a lot of film.
Yes, she was extremely photogenic. She was wonderful to capture on film while she was singing. If you see it in that film clip, you can tell that she's got a future in... you know, television and film and music videos. She was one of the first artists that was featured in music videos, partly because she was so, that the screen really loved her, you know.
Well, just to name a couple of movies, she was with Bing Crosby in Mr. Music 1950, I think. She was in the mm-hmm. remake of The Jazz Singer with Danny Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
She, and this, a lot of people may not realize, she voiced over in Lady and the Tramp.
That's right. She was
I can remember that as a kid.
Voiced, yep, she was the voice of all the female characters except for Lady and the two Siamese cats.
And she wrote that song.
Yes, she co-wrote all of that music with Sonny Burke.
I think one of her most dramatic roles was in Pete Kelly's Blues, and it was mm-hmm. a tragic role, too. And I thought she carried it off incredibly well.
I agree. She really was able to... embody that character, and not with pathos, but with I think empathy, because she had seen what alcoholism can do to a person, and she was able to really bring that to light.
Now, Dave Barber joins the orchestra, and pretty fast he becomes her new love interest, but that leads to problems because Benny Goodman doesn't want members of his band to be dating each other.
Right.
So what happens?
Well, very shortly after Benny discovered that they were an item, Dave lost his position in the group, and that was within a year. So Dave joined the group in the summer of 1942, and then he left 9 months later
Whoa.
and married Peggy Lee in March of 1943. So,
did she continue to record or play?
She left the band when Dave left the band.
Okay.
And so she just wanted to be Mrs. Dave Barber at that point.
Now, Johnny Mercer encouraged her to write her own songs, and she starts recording with Dave Barber and his orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up a long-term relationship where they're working together. They're writing songs together. How did that work for them?
Well, one story that has been shared with me by Peggy Lee's daughter, Nikki, was that he would come home from work and she would say, well, dinner's not ready, but the song's ready. So she continued to write. She would write lyrics all day long and fill up notebooks of lyrics for songs that she wanted his music to go with. And they would spend evenings writing more songs together. And so she never really stopped. You know, it was just a matter of time before her muse just finally had it out with her and she returned to full-time music.
By 1947, she was, and this is a quote from your own book, she was on her way to being the jazz pop diva that she came to embody. And she signs with a record company that she stays with for decades, Capitol Records. But there is a little break in the middle. We'll talk about them in a bit. But in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, she's at Capitol Records.
Mm-hmm.
That's 29 years.
Yeah, that's right. And she's the longest running female Capitol Records artist, second only to Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
As far as consecutive contracts. So she had consecutive contracts except for that five-year period in the middle when she voluntarily left and went and recorded with Decca.
Now, Decca was a rival of Capitol. Why did she leave, yes, Capitol to join Decca?
Well, great question. There were a few things. I think it was timed with her divorce from Dave Barber, and so possibly she needed a little bit of a change of scenery.
Okay.
And the Decca Records had a prominent place in the New York City recording scene, and she was in L.A., and she moved to New York and joined with Decca, but it had a lot to do with the fact that she wanted to record the Richard Rodgers song Lover, uh-huh, in a particular style, and Capitol didn't want to do it. They had just released the song with somebody else singing, and they weren't interested. And she was doing this in her live shows and was getting wonderful responses from people. And then a couple of Decca executives walked into her Copacabana gig, and she asked them, would you like this? Would you be interested in recording this? Because they raved over this arrangement, huh, of Lover. And they said yes, and she said, then consider it done. Because her contract was up for renewal at Capitol, and she just didn't renew it.
Now, you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Tish Oney. She's been a soloist with symphony orchestras, big bands, jazz combos throughout the world. She's a musicologist, author, multi-genre singer, arranger, composer, producer, conductor, and writer. And we're talking about her latest book, Peggy Lee, A Century of Song. One of the things you detail so many aspects of her career in this book, and I was fascinated by the importance of radio shows at the time, say mid-1940s to 1950s. Radio shows were incredibly important to appear on. Why?
Well, at that time, television wasn't what it became later. And so radio was really a forerunner of the television audience. And so as people were listening to their favorite artists on the radio, radio stations decided programming would be appropriate that featured these artists in special programs. And so they would have their own shows. They would have the Bing Crosby Show and Chesterfield Supper Club and so forth, that would bring several different artists together and have some people hosting and other people being guests. And so Peggy was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time when radio was going through this formative time, and it helped to usher her also into television and film.
It's amazing what she accomplished in this. I mean, first of all, she had her own show, the Peggy Lee Show from 1951 to 52.
Mm-hmm.
And on the I think that went by different names, like the Peggy Lee Rexall Show or whatever.
Yeah.
But she used to do Peggy's Preview on that, where she would preview a song of a recording that's going to be coming out. So obviously,
right.
All this radio work sold a lot of records.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, it definitely did.
And she also grew her personal network of contacts through this. I mean, she was a really savvy business person, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, some of the stuff she did were, I found fascinating. She had a habit of reciting poetry to lead off many of her performances.
Yes. Yes. And if you know anything about Peggy Lee's lyric writing talent, this makes perfect sense, because she was so entranced with good poetry.
Yeah.
And the power of words, that she showed this at a young age when she decided that she was going to recite some poetry on her own radio show. So she had the opportunity to produce and direct her own show to some extent, which helped her to really decide how she wanted the rest of her career to go. And she was accustomed to calling her own shots at a young, relatively young age.
Wow.
And so it was rare for a woman to have this much power over her career, but she really wielded it in a very mindful and careful way. She knew exactly what she wanted, and she was going to out to get it.
Are there recordings of her reciting these poetry before she sings?
There's a little bit available. If you research it online, you can find some old recordings of those shows, and there is a recording also available of the radio shows, the lost radio shows, and those I strongly recommend because they're really good quality, considering that they were basically live with a microphone in the room, getting everybody who was in the room, the entire band and the singer, you know, and all of the stage noise is a little bit in there too. And it was basically a live broadcast. And the quality of her performance and the performances of many other guest artists is like a live show. It's basically a live show. And to hear that one show after the next sounding just so close to perfect really gives you an idea of what she was like to watch in live performance.
That sounds incredible.
Yeah.
During the Decca years, she recorded a lot of duets with Mel Torme.
Yes.
What was Mel Torme like to work with?
Well, I'm not sure. I've never met Mel Torme, but according to Peggy. Now, when they were young, they were paired together a lot. He was younger than she, and she was more or less a young veteran. And their voices sounded great together. Their pitch was terrific. They both had a good look, you know, and they just sounded good together. So they got to work together a lot throughout their careers, and they even did late career Hollywood Bowl concerts together. But by that point, Peggy felt that Mel was a little bit difficult in the sense of wanting the limelight and wanting to make her look like she's opening for him and those catty things. Yeah, which at that point, you know, in the 1970s and beyond, is that really necessary for, you know, for these veterans that have been great artists for so long? So you'd hope that wouldn't happen, but it did happen to her in the 90s, actually, when she was in her 70s, and she was still being kind of treated like, who are you, you know?
Jesus.
So it's a little bit unfortunate, but she got her stings back, too, you know, toward him. She wouldn't just let it lie.
Now, the biggest release of her Decca years, and this is an album that's infinitely collectible, is Black Coffee, recorded in 1953. Talk about that album.
Yeah, Black Coffee is a pivotal album in jazz history, and it's one of the first ever concept albums, which is to say it had a theme running through all of the songs that joined them together in one concept. And before that, albums weren't put together that way. Albums were put together as a collection of recent singles by a particular artist.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. And after that, we're still using the idea of concept albums. Most albums that are released nowadays have some kind of a theme. People feel that the theme attracts attention and helps people to remember the project better than just a group of singles. So another aspect of this is, first of all, Decca was really well known as a jazz label. They had Ella Fitzgerald on that label and a number of other top jazz artists of the day. And so this was Peggy's chance to really shine in the jazz realm, where Capitol was a little bit more leaning toward popular music. And so Black Coffee was a terrific album that's just incredibly well put together. It was originally 8 tracks, and then 4 tracks were added a few years later because of the changing technology. So Decca decided that they could sell it better as the technology allowed for longer playing LPs. And so they added 4 more songs later on that fit that theme. But it wound up becoming one of the top 10 vocal jazz albums of all time. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that this is something that Peggy Lee did. And very few jazz artists, very few jazz vocalists can say that about themselves. They have a top number one, top 10 vocal jazz album of all time in their discography, and there she has it. She's got it in Black Coffee.
As you write about in the book, that this album really showcased her interpretive and vocal talents. And I just want you to speak for a minute or two about what those were that Peggy Lee had that really gave her performances that special feeling.
Sure. Well, she, as I said earlier, liked to sing in a range that was the spoken range. So it was very conversational. It was very relatable. It was down to earth. It was not pretentious. She didn't sing with a lot of histrionics. And what I mean by that is with a lot of runs and frills, and she didn't do scat singing. And she respected the scat singers immensely, but that just wasn't how she chose to express herself and how she chose to improvise. Her forte with improvisation was in the text-based improvisation, which is when you keep the text in and you change the melody and the rhythm around it. So the melody is different when she's improvising, and the rhythm is very different from what the composer wrote, but she was able to keep the lyrics intact and still improvise around it. And her power of understatement was incredible. Her timing and her phrasing was unparalleled. She was able to use the microphone in a way that very few other people even attempted, and she could get softer than pretty much anyone else in the business and still maintain 100% of the control over that rhythm and that pitch, and carry the melody in a beautiful, beautiful, expressive way. She was extraordinary at holding people's attention all the way through a song, multiplied by however many songs she was going to do that night. She just never let it go, and she could create incredible set lists, and she understood the flow of a performance, and she set up her set lists and her band introductions and her interludes and everything in ways that maximized the audience's attention on her.
The two songs she's probably best remembered for by the public is Fever and Is That All There Is. When was Fever recorded?
Fever...
approximately.
Was recorded.
I didn't mean to ask you an exact date because that's
okay.
Impossible to remember. That was awful to spring that on you.
That's okay. In the 50s.
I know, because I grew up as a kid.
I know.
And I remember that being on.
And I
don't worry about it.
And it's just not on the tip was that of my brain.
Was that immediately a hit for her?
Yes, it was. Yeah, she came up with the finger snaps.
Oh,
and ooh, she wanted.
That's what makes that song.
That does make that song. See, she really arranged it. She was not credited for arranging it, but she turned down all of the other arrangers' ideas and said, "All I want is bass, drums, and my fingers, and that's it. Just it.
Wow.
Everybody else, go away." You know, they wanted a saxophone or a trumpet lead. No. She knew what she wanted. She knew what it needed to be, and
wow,
that song took shape because of her ideas.
We're almost completely out of time, and I just want to address the fact that later in her years, she had horrible health challenges, but she would still perform in a wheelchair.
Yes, she was performing in a wheelchair. She couldn't give it up. You know,
wow,
if this was what she felt called to do with her life,
yeah,
and as
yeah,
long as she had breath, she wanted to sing. So she was using oxygen backstage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, after a bout with pneumonia in the 70s, she had to have oxygen for all of her performances brought to the stage. So she would go off stage and breathe and come back out and finish the show, and in a wheelchair many times. And so, yeah, she was really becoming more and more fragile, but she was just not willing to give it up.
The
and
other thing,
Fever, by the way, was in 1958.
Okay.
Recorded.
I apologize.
That's
but
okay.
The other thing that impresses me is that she was always experimenting with whatever music was current. And,
yes,
and ended up, she co-wrote songs with Quincy Jones. I mean, she did all sorts of amazing things right up until the end of her life.
Yes, she did. She was always embracing new composers. Even from her radio hosting days, she would bring on composers and have a whole show devoted to their compositions.
Wow.
And she was one of the first people to be a composer advocate because she herself was writing music. And so in the 70s, in the 1970s, she would get alongside Neil Sedaka and Dave Brubeck and Paul McCartney and want to collaborate with them because they were the up-and-comers. They
yep,
were the new, young, bright minds in the business, and she wanted to welcome them to the business and help them.
Oh, wow.
And in turn, record, show her homage to them by recording their songs.
We're completely out of time. There's so much in this book. You know, it's deceptive because it seems like it's a regular sized book, but there's there's a lot of information in this book. My guest tonight is Dr. Tish Oney. She's been a soloist with symphony orchestra, big bands, jazz combos throughout the world. She's a musicologist, author, multi-genre singer, arranger, composer, producer, conductor, and I bet she's a Peggy Lee fan. Do you cover any Peggy Lee songs when you perform?
Oh, I do. I had a touring Peggy Lee tribute concert for a number of years that's actually available again for her centennial. And it was put together with her former band members, John Chiodini and Bob Leatherbarrow,
nice,
and a number of others. And so, yeah, we've taken her music on tour a lot.
And her new book, Peggy Lee.
Recorded.
Peggy Lee, A Century of Song. Tish, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on this show.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight.